Phone check. 1, 2, the microphone check. 1, 2, 1, 2, the microphone check. I got my headphones tuned between two different AM stations, and my briefcase is full of declassified information. Declassified, declassified, and I'm reading it under the lens of your radio. I'm dissecting it and bleeding it. I read the world for breakfast, and after lunch I write it. I let me get me down, and then I stand back up and fight it. I read the news today, oh boy, oh boy. I know linguistics, statistics, pundits, and mystics. I voted for Ralph Nader. I read Docs and Raider. I got 1,000 signatures and sent them to Darth Vader. I'm reading U.S. News and World Report, Time Life, and The Post. I know more than other DJs because I read the most. And when I squint to the west, I can see Afghanistan. I put my head between my knees and I can see Iran. I get documents online and then I analyze them. They know I'm out there waiting so they don't declassify them. I bug the White House and I bug the Pentagon. In the filling in my molar, I got my descrambler on. I got the truth. I got Paul Muth. We got better lines than Haydn Carruth. We put our 11 cents in, just like Marx and Lenin. Paul's like Carl McCartney, but I'm John Lennon. We'd love to turn you on. I say I want a revolution, and I want to stop it all. I finished all 3 volumes up of Marx's Capital. You know, everything that old boy wrote is up on my shelf, and every single bit I translated myself. I'm reading and I'm learning, and when the tide is turning, it'll warm my heart in part to see the dollar bills burning. They weren't built in a day, but all roads lead to Rome. I'll do fine just as the Romans with my main man, Rome. I'd like to tell you a story about a little man, if I can. A gnome whose name was Chomsky. I'm MCS of the Rook. I got a voice like milk. I'm the best dressed man you ever heard. Can you hear this tie? It's silk.
It's mid-morning on the last day of the week, and you're listening to News from Neptune. Carl Estabrook and Paul Muth discussing the news of the week and its coverage by the media. Archives of this show in free software formats are available at newsfromneptune.com. Thanks to the technical expertise of Dr. No, Jeff Nicholson-Owens.
And here we are on the 7th of January, 2006. Paul, Alex Coburn says that what we should be waiting for, that how soon will it be before the U.S. starts providing arms to the Sunnis in Iraq in order to establish a counterweight to the Shia government that we've put in place? You think he's onto something?
The whole divide and conquer and, and pit groups off against each other is a long tradition of empire.
Yeah. Vampire or empire?
Well, vampire is empire.
Yeah, that's pretty good, yeah.
What I'm really concerned about is this meeting of the secretaries at the White House.
Why are you concerned about it? That's the silliest
thing. Because
I think
it wasn't about Iraq. I think it was about Iran.
Well,
I think it was about Iran.
No, it's about the Bush administration trying to shore up its image. They're in trouble, and they know they're in trouble. It's, you know, all ways from Sunday. Mm-hmm. I mean, from Abramoff to the situation in Iraq to the economy to the poll results to, I mean, it's just, you know, Republican revolts in the Senate and the House. I mean, they're in serious trouble, and this was an attempt to try to build up their support by putting these aged Secretary of States and Secretaries of State in line.
Let me amend that. I've been worried that was actually a fair part of the briefing that was done in secret was about Iran.
They didn't even brief them that long, did they?
It was 45 minutes. Say a little bit about Iraq, and then add in a little thing. Well, things are dire, and we want to get you all on board for our attack on Iran.
Yeah, I bet the other way, and this is something, as you say. I mean, you know, the facts will bear it out. But I just can't imagine the U.S. if they were really serious about unleashing Israel for a new Assyric in Iran, that is, bombing Iran or something of that sort. If they were serious about this, they would have been talking about it so much. I mean, that's been going on.
I don't think they want Israel to do it. I think there was an article in the Der Spiegel maybe a couple week and a half ago now saying that NATO has been advised that about an attack on.
I saw that article. Actually, I did. I looked at it because the headlines were sort of horrific, but it turned out there, the more you dug into the article, the less there was to it. I thought. I mean, you know, okay, they're talking to NATO allies. They pulled up the story of Porter Goss going off to Turkey and saying, "Hey, you guys better get ready because we might do something against Iran," and it was one of these stories which quoted earlier stories, quoting earlier stories on the same thing, you know. I mean, it was largely a rehash, I thought. I didn't think there was, although the headline suggested this was new information, there didn't seem to be much new information in it.
Well, there was continuing briefing of the NATO allies. The fact that the Iranians didn't show up to meet al-Baradei this week made me think that they have decided perhaps that it's inevitable, and that why bother with this charade of diplomacy when they're going to be attacked. So I'm hoping I'm wrong.
I'm hoping I'm wrong.
The reason I thought of it when you bring up Coburn's talking about arming some Sunni forces is the Sadr Brigade, you know, fought on the side of the Iranians during the...
The Badr Brigade. I made the same mistake a couple of weeks ago. You mean the Badr Brigade.
Badr Brigade.
Yes, right.
I didn't say Sadr.
I thought you said Sadr. Yes.
Sadr means heart, I guess, in Arabic. I'm not sure if I remember that correctly. No, the Badr Brigade... was abroad fighting against Saddam Hussein regime. They're very allied with Iran.
Yeah, that's right.
What are they going to do if we were to, you know, completely unwisely, and maybe not the case, attack Iran?
That's a very good question.
There would be another, you know, force. They're already doing a lot of damage. One hears about the, you know, these attacks on the Shia pilgrims and things like that, and how they're inciting a sectarian war, and then there are all these revelations about rounding up of Sunnis and torture and stuff.
Right.
And then they keep saying that the Shias are being restrained and they're not reacting.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's like, okay, they're not, you know, doing tit for tat, but
there's a lot of dead people for not reacting. I think you're quite right.
And they are the ones. They are the government. So
exactly.
They don't have to do the kind of, you know, the guerrilla attacks.
That's the issue.
Condoning any of it, of course. Yeah. I wish, you know, we hadn't stirred up this hornet's nest. But
I think you're onto something here. That this is exactly right. That the U.S. is really in the bizarre position right now of having produced the thing that it most feared in the Middle East. That is the beginnings of an independent power with control over energy resources. I mean, we've put a Shia government into Iraq, which has the second largest oil reserves. A Shia government, of course, in Iran, and as you say, these governments are tight. I mean, that they're quite close. The Badr Brigade is the armed wing of the Siri group, which is directly a projection of Iranian politics into Iraq. Just across the way, there is Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia oil fields are in the Shiite areas of Saudi Arabia. Now, a sort of independent Shiite association of republics, Iran, Iraq, and Saudi Arabia, is in some sense the American State Department's worst nightmare, particularly since Iran is off talking to this Russian-China-Kyrgyzstan energy grid group, you know. I mean, this is exactly what the U.S. didn't want to happen, that is, control of Middle East energy resources slipping out of its hands. And this, if the Shia are the vehicle for that departure of American control, you know, the U.S. in some sense has no one to blame but themselves for having made such a hash of Iraq.
I don't accept the premise, I don't think.
What premise?
The premise that this Shia government is going to exercise independent. I think they might.
We've got
Shalabi in the oil ministry. He's not long. I guess they're even talking about some kind of loophole where he can actually be included in the parliament.
That's right.
Despite
they got him in.
He got 330,000 votes in all of Baghdad or something like that.
No, my point is that this is exactly what the U.S. is moving heaven and earth to prevent, and that's why Alex Coburn is right when he says the next thing we'll hear is the U.S. arming the Sunnis, the people that have been excoriated as dead-enders and ex-Baathists and so forth, the insurgents, over against the Shia government that we have effectively put in place in Iraq. This morning's New York Times has on the front page an account of the U.S. talk with insurgents. insurgents. Well, the insurgents are primarily these Sunni groups, these ex-Ba'athist groups and so forth. And we know, in fact, that these talks have been going on for some time. The U.S. has these contacts, and they have them precisely as a counterweight to the sort of situation that they're concerned about.
Making
that
more
is
directly,
the Shia domination of energy resources.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it reminds me I should reprise Muhammad al-Hidi, local Iraqi American businessman and agriculturalist, actually, who pointed out that if you look at the cards of the most wanted that the U.S. released in the beginning, that 36 of them are actually Shia. So
card of
52, and you know, Tariq Aziz was Chaldean. And also the Ba'ath Party was about 1.5 million members, and about 1 million of them apparently were Shia. So,
right.
It doesn't break down on those lines, though. You know, the U.S. doing the best it can
to make it break down
on those lines. It seems like everything from hiring this guy in research, this group in Research Triangle. I forget the name of the group. They were arranging the local elections.
Yes,
and they were doing the kind of sectarian headcount thing.
Yep.
That started a lot of this. I mean, in the hinterlands, but the larger towns, there's quite a bit of intermarriage, and even the tribal groups. There are certain big tribal groups that are mixed.
Absolutely.
So
this is very true. And it's the U.S., as you suggested a moment ago, the U.S. that's been using the standard imperial technique of divide and conquer here by trying to promote the militias and the differences amongst the communities in order not to have a unified Iraq opposing the U.S. When we know that most Iraqis do oppose the occupation and are very much against it, then the U.S. has to find players within that. I mean, it's like the Brits in India in the Great Game. I mean, they've got people to play off against one another. Your mention of Chalabi and the oil ministry suggests a story from Riverbend, this wonderful woman who blogs from Baghdad. She says there's talk of major mismanagement and theft in the oil ministry. Chalabi took over several days ago, and a friend who works in the ministry says the takeover is a joke. Quote, "You know how they used to check our handbags when we first walked into the ministry?" she asked the day after Chalabi crowned himself oil emperor. "Now we check our handbags after we leave the ministry, you know, to see if Chalabi stole anything." And so that's the attitude, so to speak, on the ground in Baghdad. That blog, as usual, is a fascinating reading.
Well, let's see. What else about Iraq? This business about Pace apparently going after Murtha, supposedly.
Yeah.
This is also from Cursor. I see you've gone to cursor.org. These great guys in Minneapolis who compiles and do some really neat juxtapositions.
Yes,
too.
Yes, they do a nice job. Mm-hmm.
And Murtha was accused by Pace of hurting morale.
Pace being the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Yes.
Right. And but apparently the story of the three that they cited, the one that got the biggest circulation through CBS News, was Murtha's comment that Peter Pace told me last
night.
They know military, they can't win this thing. So. Yeah,
Murtha was wonderful again. I mean, he's pretty good on his feet. I heard his news. He did a town meeting sort of thing with Representative Jim Moran of Northern Virginia, from Northern Virginia. They did a thing in Arlington that was on C-SPAN over the weekend. And Pace, this is where Pace made where Murtha made this comment about the generals saying that Murtha, the Democratic senator who spoke out for a redeployment of getting troops out of Iraq, was responsible for low enlistments. "Look," said Murtha, "they didn't have any trouble with enlistments after 9/11. Something else must have happened." Well, you know, that's pretty good. It was an interesting talk. I mean, the two of them. Moran's a little thick, I think. I mean, he's a congressman from an area where I used to live, and, you know, he has...
He got on the wrong side of... a big campaign to de-seat him.
He's just not real smart.
East,
I mean, I think, but in fact, they're on to some good points.
Too honest, perhaps.
And he's a certain blurting honesty. Probably goes with that relative thickness. One of the things they talked about, it was a very interesting town meeting. I mean, because they let people stand up and really say some things. One guy stands up and says, "Look, I'm a veteran of this war. The people who sent us on this war didn't give us adequate equipment. It wasn't just accidental, it was criminal negligence. When are you all going to impeach them? I mean, this guy's a veteran of Iraq. And on the front page of the New York Times this morning, there's an account, I mean, just a horrifying account of the American casualties, American deaths of American soldiers as a result of inadequate armor on the vehicles they were using. A secret Pentagon study, I'm quoting now, has found that at least 80% of the Marines who have been killed in Iraq from wounds to their upper body could have survived if they had had more body armor than the Pentagon provided. And the article goes on to say how the Pentagon was criminally negligent in providing this sort of stuff.
Well, remember that active duty officer in Iraq
who put
Rumsfeld on the spot.
Well, that's right.
About that issue. And you know, I guess they don't have enough of their own cronies to make this stuff, so they haven't let the contracts yet.
It was interesting. I just want to follow this up, though, on this vet who asked for impeachment, because Murtha and Moran, these two congressmen who were holding this town meeting, were interesting on the point, two Democratic congressmen. Murtha answered the question by saying there should be a reckoning. There should be an accounting. You know, I mean, Moran jumped in and said, look, impeachment is not going to happen because it's not democratic. Democratic is the elections, and therefore vote for Democrats in the fall. But impeachment is not democratic. As I tell you, he's not a very bright guy. But I mean, the fact of the matter is, it's Moran, the Democrat, who's talking down impeachment. And the thing is, when this vet stood up in this town meeting, which was not the audience was clearly mixed on its views, the applause was tremendous for impeachment. There was an amazing outcry in favor of it. So, the Democrats are busily trying to put the lid on the demand that they do something about this.
Murtha is a Democrat, too, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So,
yeah.
So obviously, it's a
Well,
mixed,
the Democrats have been fleeing from Murtha as fast as they could ever since his initial speech on how we've got to get out of Iraq.
You're on record for about impeachment.
Well, I think it's on the agenda, Paul. I mean, I think people are talking about it in ways. Congressman Conyers has introduced a resolution calling for a special committee that would investigate the background for such a thing. Resolution 635, I think it is, House Resolution 635, for a select committee to examine this is important, mainly because there is a much greater feeling, as this vet at the town meeting in Arlington suggested, there's a much greater feeling for this sort of thing out there than there is amongst the political class. You're not going to find it from the Representative Moran's until it becomes clear that there is a demand out there for it, and I think there is.
Speaking of vets speaking to the people that planned this war, we haven't over the holidays recounted Cheney's visit to Iraq, where he was over the holidays in the schedule that we've had. We haven't gotten to it, and it's worthy of note that at a sit-down that he had with some vets, a little conference in Baghdad on his first visit there. A officer asked him, "Well, we don't really see any progress here. We just don't see it." And Cheney's response was, "Well, you shouldn't believe everything you read in the media." That was really that's the paraphrase uh-huh. of the you know, he's talking to a guy that's on the ground in Baghdad and saying, "Don't believe what you read in the paper," uh-huh. because you know that's all they have to say. Apparently, mm-hmm. It's just what the media is doing that's betraying all the good that's being done in Iraq so poorly. But the irony of it, talking to a guy who's on the ground in Baghdad who has, temerity, I wonder what happened to the guy, actually.
Yeah, somebody raised that question the other day, whatever became of that soldier who, they raised the question about the earlier guy, the one who went after Rumsfeld. So what happened to him? Well, and what happens to this guy? It's good questions, He should, these are probably not good career moves, there has been suggestions all along that Murtha's speech, Murtha is a right-wing Democratic congressman, and his speech in December saying we've got to get the troops out of Iraq was directly prompted by the uniformed military in the Pentagon who couldn't break through, who were all scared as rabbits, apparently, of the civilians in the Pentagon, Rumsfeld and his people, and therefore went to Murtha, who was known to be a sympathizer to the uniformed military, and said, look, you got to say something about this, that the impetus came from from the uniformed military from Murtha's talk.
Well,
I think
he has
that may
close
be true.
Ties, been military appropriations, and 30-year Marine himself. So.
Precisely. Yeah. I mean, you know, whoever initiated it, and I'm perfectly willing to believe that it was the military itself, that there were officers themselves who initiated the contact with Murtha, it's clear that he speaks for them.
Yeah.
I'm, you know, a whole list of things here that need to be talked about. Did you hear about Bush's signing statement?
Oh gosh, yes.
I mean, it's amazing.
This is a
scandal.
Sign it with invisible ink. Yeah.
And talk about something done in the dark of night. We're talking about here the signing, Bush's signing of the Defense Authorization Bill, which includes the so-called McCain torture amendment and the Graham-Levin amendment about limiting habeas corpus and so forth. But what the shocking part of this, and this is worth reading, it's worth going to the White House website and getting the statement that the president, of course it wasn't the president, it wasn't George Bush, but I mean people wrote for him, the statement at the time of the signing of this bill. And it was done sort of over the weekend in the holidays in one of these Friday afternoon things that we don't hear about. So it took a while before people got to this statement. But basically what Bush says, well, this stuff about torture is very nice, but if I need torture, I'll use it. And all this talk about things that we should be doing is fine, but I'll interpret it according to my inherent powers as commander-in-chief. I mean, it was a most remarkable explicit setting aside of the rule of law by an American president I've heard of in a long, long time. Now, we know the administration is into this deeply because of the NSA spying and so forth. And by the way, the polls on that are overwhelming. People do not like the spying at all. And the administration is trying to brazen it out by saying, you know, we have inherent powers in the presidency and we're at war and therefore we can do essentially anything that we want. And they said this in writing in the signing statement for the defense bill, and this is a scandal, and this really should be talked about. That bill's got to be out there. This belongs up there with the Downing Street memo and so forth in terms of an indication of what these guys are doing and intend to do.
Now, Cheney's gambit on defending the administration went to the level of saying there wouldn't have been a 911 if we'd had already had the right to do this kind of spying, which is absolutely absurd because we know, you know, they already had a lot of evidence and didn't connect the dots. I mean, in San Diego, two of the people that were involved had a FBI informant housemate or neighbor or something who was watching them. It's absolutely outrageous.
Well, it's even more because they've said there was nothing we could have done to stop it. I mean, that's been Cheney himself and the others who that's been their position along. Now they say, oh yeah, there was something we could have done had we done the spying of the sort that we're doing now.
McCain and Warner and one other GOP people
Graham.
Got up. Who was it?
Graham. Lindsey Graham, yes.
Yeah.
Quite remarkable. Yes, go ahead with this, because this is a remarkable point.
They got up and said, this quietly reserving the right to bypass the law is absolutely absurd. You know,
and this is important, Paul, because I mean we're talking about three, you know, conservative Republican senators: the chairman of the Armed Service Committee, Warner of Virginia; Lindsey Graham, who's a right winger and responsible for the anti habeas corpus amendment that's in that bill, and who was the third one? Graham, Warner, and McCain.
McCain, of course.
Yeah, McCain, who wants to be president. But these are three Republican senators saying, wait a minute, you know, you can't do that to Bush. This signing statement is wrong.
Graham has his name on that anti-habeas corpus.
Yes, he does.
Levin does, too. Levin was on the spot this week because apparently they said it was retroactive.
Exactly. That's the Justice Department's position.
And that
it was the other way around, I think.
Well, no, the Justice Department is this blanket. It's no cases at all.
But what Levin said was what the Levin
previous
said.
Cases were allowed to go.
That's
ahead,
right. It wasn't retroactive, and the Justice Department moved to dismiss all the previous cases up to now, like 180 cases of folks at Gitmo saying, applying to the courts. And Levin is saying that was not what we had in mind.
You wonder how explicit it was.
Well, exactly.
I was shocked that he was on it at all. Personally, he's done some fairly good work. This is senior senator from Michigan, right? Levin?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Carl Levin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Alito apparently figures in this story of these bypass side agreements. Apparently, while he was apparatchiked in the Reagan administration, he champion and maybe wrote some of the statements that Reagan penned.
Yeah, I'm really sorry to see the Democrats going into the tank for Alito, as they seem to be doing. I think they could beat him because of the mood in the country right now. I mean, if they can time to the sorts of things the administration is doing here, which, as you suggest, they probably can, I think they have a much better chance against him than I would have said they did, you know, before Christmas. We'll be interesting to see how this plays out, because they want to have it done by the end of the month. But I think if they're serious about going after Alito on this untrammeled power of the presidency line, when you have Republican senators standing up and saying this is wrong, it's hard for me to believe that there isn't a constituency for opposition to Alito on these matters.
Yeah. Well, we talked about the corporate
absolutely.
Aspect of his. I heard a piece on NPR that sort of had a person from Chicago, a woman dismissing the fact that he is he's so corporate friendly. When it's interesting to note,
she was dismissing that point.
Yeah. I forget her name at this point. I was going to actually write her and say how absurd it sounded, because the other stuff in the report actually undermined her point, but they ended on her note actually.
Well,
Althaus, I guess her name was, and. You know, it's when Rehnquist didn't believe that corporations should be, you know, given complete, you know, individuality, you know, the whole idea of personhood of the corporation.
Right.
Rehnquist wasn't even that on board for that. But Alito is to the right of Rehnquist.
Yes, indeed.
In enshrining corporations as having all rights of that are named in the Constitution to citizens, when
exactly.
These are legal fictions, you know.
Right. Look, I've been saying all along that the essential characteristic that this administration has been looking for in Supreme Court justices, whether it's Roberts or Myers or Alito, has been business friendliness. These are the Bush looters saying, all right, now it's payoff time. We want these people because they're the ones who are going to affect our business interests in the coming years. And it's clear to everybody. I mean, this is why I'm sort of shocked by the woman you quote. Even the AP this week, the Associated Press, ran an article by Donna Cassata entitled Roberts Alito Side with Business. That's the title of the article. And I'm quoting, this is the Associated Press, business couldn't do any better than Chief Justice John Roberts and Samuel Alito on the Supreme Court. The prospect of the two on the Supreme Court signals to manufacturers and businesses that they will have allies in high places, say academics and business experts.
Yeah.
Close quote.
Yeah.
That's not some lefty rag there.
I don't think the main, for this administration presently, where they are right now, business is, you know, an important part, but the main part is to...
It's not an important part, you say?
No, I said it's a very important part.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Part, but I think the main point for them now is the preservation of executive power, because that's the only thing that's going to save their
hides. That's resting on a fairly weak reed at the moment. Look, we had, I think, an amazing example of that this week in the Sega and the West Virginia mine disaster. The coverage of that, the way that was approached, the revelation of the evisceration of the Mine Safety Administration in this administration, and the friendliness of both government and media to the buccaneer capitalists who owned that mine and produced the circumstances that killed those people, is just not to be believed.
Yeah.
I'm sitting here watching CNN, and here is this bottom feeder of the capitalist world, Wilbur Ross, who owns the thing, being consoled by Paula Zahn over the loss of the miners. He's the reason for it.
Yeah.
He's the reason. And she, you know, and then she, with a, you know, a sort of nod of sympathetic nod of the head, she reaches across the table and shakes his hand. We're awfully sorry for your loss, she said.
Well, I was wondering what
such garbage.
I was wonder whether maybe that's what stiffened the spine of the ABC reporter whose name escapes me, but he was also the person that that Amy Goodman had on this week, who had done the reporting on the Marianas Islands.
Yes.
And the Tom DeLay, Abramoff effort to allow Made in America to not honor any of labor laws in the USA. This same guy actually confronted the guy and said, when are you giving some of your own money? Isn't $2 million a small amount for these 13 deaths,
right.
et cetera, et cetera? I mean, this guy, he was the... he may have come right from CNN and didn't expect it. He didn't know how to react to hear this kind of challenging of his position. And, you know, the guy said, "You're a billionaire. What's going
exactly.
on here? Why don't you come forth with some of your own money? Don't you feel somewhat responsible for this?" And the guy looked like a deer in the headlight, but you know, toughed it out as it were, and didn't, you know.
There were dozens of safety violations in this mine, safety violations for which International Coal Group, that Wilbur Ross is the non-executive chairman of, and the owner of, dozens of complaints, many of them serious, the result was minuscule fines from the corporation, $14,000 in total. $14,000 is, you know, is lunch money for this man, Ross.
Divided into the number of citations, you know, it's
exactly.
like a parking ticket for each time.
And they don't fix the problems. Ross is, by the way, Ross is not a Republican, a Bushite looter here. He's a Democratic looter. He's a very big Democrat, close to the steel workers and to Kerry. He was married to the woman Betsy McGowey, the lieutenant governor of New York, who challenged Pataki a couple of years ago and then disappeared without a trace. And actually, I think they're not married anymore. But the point is that he belongs to this same business class that both the Democrats and the Republicans represent. He happens to be on the Democratic side of it, but that didn't bother the Republican administration any. They still went easy on him and his company in regard to this mine. As a result, these people are dead. I mean, the scandal is outrageous, Paul, and it's just the reporting simply adds to it.
And that's exactly why the Democrats won't go after Alito on his corporate friendliness.
Exactly. Amen.
Yeah.
You're precisely right. You're listening to News from Neptune, Carl Easterbrook and Paul Muth talking about the state of the world.
Anti-war, anti-racism effort. It's holding a demo today from 2 to 4. Is that correct?
2 to 4 in downtown Champaign, on the corner of Main Street and Neal Street, against the war and the occupation and associated social evils. There is a nationwide series of protests this weekend, Paul, across the country, organized by the After Downing Street group.
Oh, really?
Yeah, some 140 demonstrations around the country. The National Out of Iraq Day, I think is what they're calling it. And this AWARE demonstration, AWARE is our local anti-war group, this AWARE demonstration is part of that series. And AWARE remains, as I say, a local anti-war group that holds open meetings at the Independent Media Center in Urbana every Sunday evening at 5 o'clock, and everyone is welcome to that, too. The coal mining deaths affected the stock prices of International Coal Group by less than 10%. I'm surprised it made that much difference. I mean, everyone's cheering the fact that the Dow Jones average is trembling. I think that Friday's high was the highest since a year ago, October. This doesn't make too much difference. I mean, the Wilbur Ross is not worried where his next meal is coming from, and it's a lot of his success, if that's the word, has to do with his association with the Democrats, the administration, and unions like the steelworkers, who are big friends of his.
The name hasn't come to me of this correspondent, but I think getting into Abramoff the way that Amy Goodman did is an excellent way.
Jack the Flipper?
This business about the Marianas Island and sweatshops, you know, Chinese worker coming in and signing deals that they can't get pregnant, and all sorts of stuff. And it's the fact that ABC News did a story on this, what, in 99, I guess, six years or so ago now, was pretty amazing. Amy actually pulled that out of the vault and interviewed the correspondent that did it, and I still can't remember his name. But it's admirable that they did it. And it's not just, I think there's some sentiment in the world that it's, you know, this casino business and Abramoff running libertarian Republicans against Christian fundamentalist Republicans to drum up business, etc. But he's been involved in quite a bit other things and delays in the thick of it with him. And this American Family Network, another high irony of calling a slush fund that they were using to pay Delay's wife an incredible amount of money to figure out what the Congress people's favorite charities were, which took her apparently a year and a half.
Well, it's sort of like those folks working for, you know, who were trying to figure out what Bill Moyer's politics were when they were working for the FCC.
All they had to do was turn on the tube.
That's right. There may be a problem here.
But apparently, the guy down in Texas is going to dig into the
Earl, the prosecutor in Texas?
Ronnie Earl has broadened the Delay inquiry to include election spending, reports the Washington Post, demanding documents related to the funds that passed through the nonprofit organization, the U.S. Family Network.
Yeah, isn't that great? We're talking here about Jack Abramoff, lobbyist who has pled guilty to various charges in fraud already and apparently is talking to prosecutors. There's an aspect of this, Paul, that I think is quite interesting, given the control of the Justice Department that, of course, the President administration has, the fact that the FBI has gone after Abramoff and that they have indeed forced him to plead guilty on these things, or the Justice Department has forced him to plead guilty on these things, and that they are flipping him to testify against a good number of members of Congress. And that's very interesting. I mean, this is an indication of the way in which the bureaucracy continues to function, even under ideological administration control. And, I mean, I suppose that should be faintly heartening, although there are some cracks in the facade. One of the things not much mentioned about Abramoff, Jack the Flipper, is that he's an example of one of these right-wing American Jews who funds terrorists on the West Bank. What originally apparently attracted the FBI's interest was the fact that the money that Abramoff was getting from American Indian tribes was being sent to buy sniper materials and so forth to arm settlers on the West Bank in Israel. And the FBI sort of scratched their head over this and said, why were American Indian tribes supporting the Yabotinskyites on the West Bank?
There's so many slush funds, et cetera. My understanding was it was a charity that was supposed to give money to inner city youth was actually diverted to do this. And it was carefully not buying guns directly, because I think the Neutrality Act would have been, but it was like night vision goggles and sniper sights and that sort of stuff that was used to arm against. I think this was at the beginning of the Second Intifada, the one that Sharon set off by this demonstration of force and going up to the what's called some places the Temple Mount and some places the.
I would say the Israeli army set off by firing a million bullets in the first 3 days and whatever, and by killing many more Palestinians than any Israelis who died.
Well,
but in any
but back to the point,
I'm after is, why did they go after Abramoff if he is so tightly tied in to the Republican establishment? I mean, he was part of the answer, I think, is the independent foreign policy vis-a-vis Israel that was being run here. Remember, he was close to Delay, who is a Christian Zionist, as he says. I mean, one of these extreme supporters of the most extreme elements in Israeli politics. And I think that one of the things that was happening here was that the Justice Department wanted to shut that down. And then when they looked into that, you know, then the rest of these things came unraveled, and they couldn't put it back together again. They had to go on with it.
But
explain to me why in the world this Justice Department would go after Jack Abramoff.
Well, there is a call for the recusal of one person who's on this case because she's too connected, and it seems like a Democrat's calling for an independent prosecutor would be a reasonable thing. I don't know where you'd get that. Another job for Fitzgerald or something, you know, there is some lower level career people that the journalism is actually not suppressing the story, like the NSA spying story, which
itself
suppressed for
requires some explanation.
But
one of the lower level people you're talking about is not even that low. Much of, we know the name in one case. This man, James Comey, who was a deputy attorney general and was responsible for getting Ashcroft to recuse himself on the Wilson Plain matter, and also convincing Ashcroft to appoint Patrick Fitzgerald, a friend of Comey's, as the special prosecutor there. Now, it's come out that Comey, who, by the way, has gone to work for Lockheed Martin, I think, now. He's doing okay. at 10 times the salary, that Comey was also the guy from who said to the administration when the administration in the person of Andrew Card and Alberto Gonzalez came to the Justice Department to say, we want some approval for going on with this NSA spying we've been doing. Comey said, gee, you can't do that. You know, that's not legal. And Card and Alberto treated that contempt with what the remark they thought it deserved and went on to Ashcroft, who was in the hospital at that time having his gallbladder operated
on. That's some kind of pancreatitis problem.
And they said to Ashcroft, you know, will you sign off on this thing? And according to the account that's been in the papers, it's not clear whether Ashcroft did that.
He didn't do it immediately.
Ashcroft was reluctant, exactly.
He didn't do it immediately.
The idea that the nation's liberties were being protected by Attorney General Ashcroft is a little hard to credit, I admit. But as I say, there was this man, Comey, who was strengthening his backbone while his gallbladder was being removed, and it's not at all clear that Ashcroft did it. It may be the White House went on its own, not without the Department of Justice approval, but your point about there being lower-level people in the administration or in the bureaucracy saying these are things you can't do is incarnated in this man, James Comey, who, of course, is no longer in the Department of Justice.
I don't know if the pain pill stopped Ashcroft, or maybe what they held out for was...
Oh, it was the drugs.
A direct call from Bush with the right kind of pill for Ashcroft to make him change his mind on
could well be
being recalcitrant to overturn the person that he had turned over the running of the Justice Department while he was on hiatus. I actually probably think that he just would say, well, I'm recused right now. I'm out. I've turned over.
But he hadn't recused. Oh, well, he hadn't in general.
He was temporarily not in charge of the Justice Department.
But Card and Gonzalez went to him for his approval.
Right,
so, Noam Chomsky actually had a piece that appeared in the International New Edition of Newsweek. I don't know what it appeared in the print edition at all, but online, in which Chomsky says, and I think this is worth pondering, Bush, he says, is more or less a symbol, but I think the people around him are the most dangerous administration in American history. That's quite a comment. I think they're driving the world to destruction. There are two major threats that face the world, threats of the destruction of the species, and they're not a joke. One of them is nuclear war, and the other is environmental catastrophe, and they're driving toward destruction in both domains. They're compelling competitors to escalate their own offensive military capacity, Russia, China, now Iran. That means putting their offensive nuclear missiles on hair trigger alert. The Bush administration has succeeded in making the United States one of the most feared and hated countries in the world. The talent of these guys is unbelievable. They have even succeeded at alienating Canada. I mean, that takes genius, literally. Close quote. Yeah, I mean,
after
for all
got
the,
this more pliable guy in, Martin, too. And
for all the joke at the end, I mean, you know, Chomsky is clearly not joking, and he's not one prone to joke. The business of calling the Bush people, and of course, personalizing this in George Bush is pointless, but to call the Bush people the most dangerous administration in American history, that's strong language. And it suggests that, things are very bad indeed, because, of course, you know, the most fight comes from cornered rats. That's right. And I think the administration is increasingly cornered on a number of issues right now. And this leads us back to your original point about what they might do in regard to Iran. I think the circumstances that would produce something absolutely mad, like an attack on Iran, are the administration really driven into a corner thinking the only way they can do it is to generate their own new 9/11.
Yeah, well, I think they're feeling pretty cornered right now.
I think you're right.
Here's a little thing about how the media might respond to all of this. It's been noted in Cursor again that NBC scrubbed a transcript of a question of Andrea Mitchell, wife of stepping down.
Yeah. Not that she isn't pretty well connected, you're suggesting, huh? The wife of the Fed chairman of Greenspan.
She asked this guy, James Risen, who has the book out, who acquiesced in the editors not publishing the material, the leak about the NSA, the multiple leaks about the NSA being unsettled about doing this eavesdropping. He asked...
Which he had before the election, you mean, yes.
Yeah, she asked about eavesdropping of journalists, specifically Christiane Amanpour, who I guess is with CNN. And apparently that question and answer. I don't know if the answer was substantive in any way. Rather, Eisen knew much about journalists being eavesdropped on.
He said he didn't know anything about it, but yeah, I mean, the fact was the one who mentioned it.
But the question was taken out of, I guess they're going to rationalize and say, well,
yeah,
he didn't.
That's right.
The transcript was, the whole question and answer were taken out.
Exactly right.
They're just going to say, well, it was editorial because there was no substantive reply.
Isn't that incredible? But, yeah. And we know this is nothing new. Remember, we had the case not so long ago of the White House calling upon a news organization to alter the transcript. It put it up. They quoted what Scott McClellan actually said,
yeah,
and McClellan wanted to revise and extend his remarks on the news site's transcript. So, yeah, this administration is perfectly capable of doing it. And
I remember predicting his resignation at the end of a show not so long ago, but I think he's got completely...
Well, his mother's not running as a Republican anymore, I gather.
Oh,
yeah.
His brother is in charge of... the Federal Drug and or some has some portfolio at the Federal Drug Administration, and he's done an Ashcroft, which is to not be non-compliant in a inquiry about the holding back of Plan B, the contraceptive agent, or the morning after pill, I guess it's called. So
more
I don't know.
More uncomfortable questions for Scott. Huh?
One of the two of them is I think should resign, but they apparently have don't have any compunctions about just getting up and lying one or non-complying again and again.
He's such a right, because he's clearly not enjoying his job, where his predecessor was such a snake that he actually seemed to get a kick out of it, you know. But McClellan, I mean, to watch McClellan sweat when they show these White House reporters' discussions, or even to read the transcript, is really quite something.
It used to be entertaining. Now it's just gotten banal because it's just so...
Because he says nothing. But Helen Thomas must haunt his dreams, huh?
Well, he doesn't catch her gaze at all anymore, and then a question was out of the question, so all she gets to do is say something after the press briefing about the question she would have liked to have asked.
Did you see where Angela Merkel, the new German chancellor, who's on her way to Washington to meet with the boy emperor at the end of the week?
I haven't heard anything about her lately.
Yeah, no, she says, yeah, I mean, she was interviewed. I saw this is the Financial Times. She was interviewed before she, what are you going to do in Washington? They ask her. She says, well, I'm going to ask President Bush to close Guantanamo Bay, the president of Guantanamo Bay. She says it's an embarrassment. It's you know, it's shocking for them to be running a you know, a prison like this. I mean,
I'll repeat my stance: as we ought to pull off Cuba. This is 1898 lease that expired some years ago now, and all it is now is just a colonial outpost. So.
But not only have you not heard, I think I could be wrong. Perhaps this has been reported in the American media, but you've not heard the German chancellor calling for a closing of Guantanamo. This is a right-wing German chancellor, too. Remember, but the Financial Times goes on to say that the suggestion may not be inappropriate, in that the U.S. is busily building a new Guantanamo in Afghanistan. Now. They and it's wonderful. They are remodeling an old Soviet prison in Afghanistan in order to put the Guantanamo detainees further away from the American courts. Remember, I mean, what you were saying about Cuba. In the administration's mind, the reason to have the prison in Guantanamo was in the first place was that they argued Guantanamo was outside the scope of American laws, that the administration could do anything it wanted to in Guantanamo, and the courts couldn't touch them because it wasn't on American soil. Well, the courts said, not too effectively, that wasn't so. But now the U.S. wants to move its prison into, you know, the war zone, where the September 2001 authorization for military force does put it totally under the control of the administration, or so the administration
argues.
It
can be nominally run by the Afghanis, too.
Exactly, so. Sure.
I mean, it's like taking this over a Russian prison is what was done in Eastern Europe, too.
Exactly.
So, I mean,
this is a vast, extraordinary rendition. They're going to render the entire 500 and some detainees in Guantanamo, perhaps. But, I mean, this is remarkable, Paul, on several levels. First of all, the rest of the world's outrage and astonishment and revulsion at what the U.S. is doing, and the U.S. willingness to continue to do what it's been doing.
Let's see. In the last 10 minutes here, a couple of more items. I noted that the Cato Institute still hasn't made any public comment on their website about this Bandow, who is apparently defending his taking money from Abramoff to write, what did we say, 26 or so op-eds about the pleasures and greatness of deregulation, mm-hmm. for specifically focusing on Abramoff's clients, it seems. So not the native tribes. So apparently there's some long, he put an op-ed up in the Times, this Cato. But Cato itself has no comment on, they have a section of people in the news, but they haven't commented on this Bandow guy who had to resign. You know, it seems like they should at least make some kind of a statement on it. Another case of buying, you know, opinions in the media, done so well and so widely.
Joseph Stiglitz, the Nobel Prize winner in economics, who used to be the World Bank's economist, is presenting a paper with a colleague from Harvard arguing that the cost of the war is not the $100 billion or even $200 billion or more that you've heard about. The cost of the war is in the range of $1 trillion and perhaps as much as $2 trillion. I mean, this is quite astonishing.
He's not citing opportunity costs, is he? This
no,
is
but
a lovely thing about...
But he is trying to do a serious accounting of the cost that the war has produced and tried to show how the war is so deforming of American society right now, that this has not been done on the cheap. This has not been done even with the funding from abroad as the first Gulf War was. But this is coming out of the muscle of the American economy. And at the same time, although Stiglitz doesn't say this in his paper, the business press, there's a rumble of discontent in the business press and elsewhere. An awful lot of folks are worrying that the indicators are for a downturn in the American economy, in spite of what the stock market did this week, that a recession is on the way, what they call the inverted yield curve, the fact that Treasury notes are paying more than long-term Treasury bonds, and that doesn't happen very often, and when it does, it's often presaged a recession. It's got a lot of people worried, and there are a lot of worries about the American economy. One indication of what Stiglitz and his friends are talking about, the vast hidden costs of this war, is the fact that the budget that the Bush administration intends to introduce next month has no new funds for reconstruction in Iraq. Nothing. Mm-hmm. Zero. Zip.
And the money that has been for reconstruction has
it's all been stolen.
Been reprogrammed or stolen. Yeah.
Exactly.
Reprogrammed for security costs.
Exactly.
To protect the people that aren't working on making lives better.
To go back to where we started today, maybe to provide arms for the Sunnis, who will be seen by the Americans as a check on the Shia government that they have, to their dismay, put in place in Iraq. And in the meantime, people continue to die at tremendous rates. 130 people dead on Thursday, including a dozen American soldiers, from what we hear. I mean, astonishing stuff.
Well, Stiglitz introducing that makes me think of the IMF and World Bank, and I have a note here to comment on what I heard on the BBC about, since Argentina and Brazil both apparently are paying off their IMF loans, the business plan at the IMF needs to be restructured.
That's
because
right.
They don't seem to be having enough money coming in on
exactly.
interest to fund their own $1 billion a year costs.
So if your banker can't make loans, he's in trouble.
And I wonder whether this was calculated in any way, whether the Southern Cone, you know, our backyard, might have looked far enough ahead to say, well, if we, you know, this, you know, that's, there's reasons to do it, to get the structural adjustment gurus off the backs of Argentina and Brazil,
well,
and let them do other policies, perhaps, finally.
And, you know, go ahead.
But you know, you wonder also whether somebody wasn't cranking the numbers and saying, you know, this is...
We could bring them to their knees, yes. That is very interesting. There are other roundabout aspects of this problem that were interesting. One that I was struck this week, that a couple of groups in the U.S. that are concerned, that were basically pro-Israeli groups, but have charged President Chavez of Venezuela with making anti-Semitic comments in a State of the Nation speech, And but the what's most interesting about this is the remedy proposed. These groups have then called upon the other members of Mercosur not to do business with Chavez. That is to keep Venezuela out of this Latin American Free Trade Organization. Latin American trade organizations being set up in opposition to American attempts to control trade in the hemisphere. So what's most remarkable here is that these comments are being used as an occasion to say, well, the remedy is to do what the American government wants and isolate Venezuela economically.
And what was the root of the allegation? Perhaps some criticism of Israel, since that's a common phenomenon.
The text as I saw it, and I have not seen the full text of what Chavez was supposed to say, did seem to include notions of world finance and its connections to world Jewry. And so what the significance, what Chavez was saying and what it meant is not clear, I'd like to get it clear, but the remedy proposed is the American government's plan for world finance.
Yeah, I heard one attack on him that was based on this NED-funded group. A couple of people wanted to attend some free market conference up here in D.C. They had to check in with the government before they left the country. Now this is this was regarded as sort of some creeping police state. Whereas if somebody's under investigation for trying to overthrow the government, you would think that maybe they might have some limitations on their passport. It would seem to me. And this I forget the name of the group, but it's the one that's Venezuela Info. I forget the there are a number of good groups that are trying to remedy the disinformation about Venezuela. And they include this group as being the NED-funded outfit that, had meetings with the administration prior to the April coup a couple years ago, coup attempt, I should say.
Amidst all the hand-wringing that you've heard on NPR for the state of health of the Prime Minister of Israel, and I must admit, Paul, it seemed interesting to me that if you compared the way NPR treats the death watch of Sharon with the death watch for Arafat, you had a very different feeling. I mean, the Sharon one is done from inside. This is our guy, and the Arafat death watch was done, this is an enemy.
Well, hospital in France. I mean,
any pretense of even-handedness here on NPR is out of the question.
Well, did I mention the comment that rang a bell for both of us from Scott Simon? We didn't do a Simon watch. He said something about his last question, I think, in an overwhelmingly soporific discussion, was citing the inadvertent responsibility for Sabra Shatila.
Yes, exactly.
That a commission incredible. Israel actually did. And that's...
I ruined my morning by listening to NPR Weekend Edition again, and I really thought it was one of the weaker ones.
Prompt sucker fit large. Yeah.
While they were talking about Sharon, it was reported this week that 3,386 Palestinians have been killed since October of 2000, and the Second Intifada began. And at the same time, 992 Israelis have been killed. So the difference is between 3 and 4 to 1. And what we hear, including on quite a remarkable program on Israel's security problem and how they're dealing with terrorism. And, the numbers are clear. Terrorism begins to be a problem when the number of Palestinians killed to the number of Israelis drops down to below 4 to 1 rather than 10 to 1 as it was in the first weeks of the Intifada.
You want to recommend the 45th minute of the interview with this Benjamin Tool that you interacted to? Zygmunt is just upstairs, and he doesn't realize Zygmunt is taking credit for. Yeah, I wanted
to call
him, but I'd already. The guy was such a, he's playing dumb apparently,
but
or maybe he is that ignorant.
It should be clear who this is. This guy was a speechwriter for Clinton.
Right.
I mean, this is the Democratic, the position of Kerry. Yeah.
He claimed credit for planning the retaliation against Afghanistan and Sudan, where they bombed the aspirin factory.
This is the Richard Clark, Randy Beers. A line of people supporting Clark and so forth. This is what we were hearing from this fellow.
Didn't know
Thursday,
about the car bombing in Beirut.
Yeah,
that, you know,
and
the U.S. and Brit sponsored. Amazing.
Incredible. We're out of here.
We're out of here, yeah.
Yeah, God willing, we'll be back next week. Take care of yourself, Paul. Merry Christmas, according to the Julian calendar.